Well, hello there. Who are you?
This is the Zodiac speaking.
Killing must feel good to God, too. He does it all the time. And are we not created in his image?
We all go a little mad sometimes.
After all, murder is, or should be, an art.
I could kill you now pretty easily. Do some interesting things before anyone showed up.
What are these films you can't wait to look at?
Welcome to the Final Girls Podcast and the third episode of our series dedicated to on-screen serial killers from the silent to the Marvel era. I'm Anna Bogutskaya, your podcast host and problematic Mitchum stan. I'm joined by film critic Christina Nealon to dive deep into Charles Laughton's only feature film as a director, 1955's The Night of the Hunter, starring Robert Mitchum as the sex-hating serial killer con man Harry Powell. The film is an outlier in every single sense. It's a black and white horror fairy tale made at a time when Technicolor musicals were all the rage. It stars a sex symbol movie star as its main, virulently violent antagonist who preys on widows to kill them and get their money, and contains a multitude of impossible shots from the point of view of two small children on the run from this fake preacher. The Night of the Hunter is a singular and weird film, and one whose fingerprints you can feel all over cinema, even though Laughton, regrettably, never made another film as a director. If you've never seen The Night of the Hunter, please consider this to be your invitation to do so. It's been restored, it's readily available, and it's completely unmissable. If you're horror curious but worried about the darker or more intense entries in the genre, even in the serial killer genre, then this one is for you. You can see what other films I'm going to be covering during the series over on the Final Girls Letterboxd page, which I also link to in the show notes. And with all of that said, please enjoy our take on The Night of the Hunter. Christina, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. You were the only person that I'd asked to come on to talk about The Night of the Hunter, and I'm really pleased we managed to work it out.
Yeah, thank you for asking me. You correctly assumed that I would be madly in love with this movie, which, yeah, I have been since for a long time, since I was young.
Same. And we'll get into that in a bit. But before we start, and this is something I ask of everyone who comes into the show for the first time, what is your personal relationship with horror?
I think it's an interesting one. It's really developed for me over the years, and I still feel very much like a dabbler. Like, if there is any genre that I would say that I am not as conversant in as other major American genres, I would say it's horror. I think it's because I was just terrified as a kid, and I didn't really watch even very, very famous horror films like Texas Chainsaw Massacre and The Shining and stuff until I was 18 or 19. So I didn't grow up on a steady diet of slashers and things like that, like a lot of teenagers do. Mm-hmm. And even as I became really interested in film, I still, like, I have a very visceral reaction to horror. So even now, like, I'm fully the person that's going to, like, hide behind their hands or, like, shriek, or, like, if I'm home, like, I'll be behind a cushion. Like, I just have a visceral reaction to horror.
Which is kind of the best kind of reaction you can have. I'm really jealous of people like you who can still have this very, very intense reaction to horror films. You know, I feel like it dulls a little bit as you watch more and more. And I'm always, always chasing that same full body experience that I used to have.
Yeah, I mean, it is one of the really fun things about horror for me is that as kind of I go on various journeys of discovery and figuring out kind of the things that do particularly scare me, like the things that I do really like to watch, and, you know, kind of being like watching Talk to Me in the past year and being like really, really shook at seeing it in the cinema.
And, you know, going into the theme that I'm covering this season, you know, what do you think of when you think of serial killers in the movies?
Well, it's a funny one with Night of the Hunter. Maybe part of the reason that, you know, some of the appeal of it was that, of course, it is about a serial killer, but it's not really what I think of when I think of even classic horror. I think of like The Haunting or films like that that are more traditional, kind of like I think Ghost Stories, or I think of, you know, if I think of serial killer films, I think of more contemporary things like Silence of the Lambs. So I think maybe that my lack of labeling Night of the Hunter as a serial killer film maybe was part of the reason why I ended up getting so into it. Because I do think I started out with some biases against horror.
I think it's interesting, and I really wanted to include Night of the Hunter in this series because I also did not approach it thinking it was a horror film. I came into it thinking, oh, it's a classic film. It's a classic film that very much a Hollywood film. It's a Robert Mitchum film. I want to watch it because of that, not because of it belongs in a particular genre. So tell me about how you first encountered the Night of the Hunter.
It's funny, you know, because I was trying to think about this, you know, and I can remember thinking that it was incredible, but I can't really remember seeing it for the first time. Mm-hmm. I think maybe because it's the sort of film that feels like once you have seen it, it's kind of just imprinted on your brain forever. Mm-hmm. Like, it is one of the most deeply memorable films I've ever seen. And I've seen it quite a few times, but I think perhaps, if memory serves, I first learned about it through watching Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing and the famous reference to Night of the Hunter where he's got love and hate tattooed on his knuckles. And I think I read something or saw something about that homage that Spike Lee was paying to the Charles Laughton film. And that was probably where I first found out about it. But yeah, it's just such a haunting, spellbinding viewing experience.
And tell me kind of what do you think makes it such a haunting viewing experience, and why do you think kind of it imprints itself in people's memories?
I mean, there are so many things to recommend it. There's, of course, Robert Mitchum's incredible performance, but I think as much as anything, it's two things, which is the look and the sound of the film. The music is really sort of, it sounds like this kind of like enchanting, eerie sound from like another land. And then there's this kind of, I think it was Charles Laughton who called it a nightmarish Mother Goose story.
Yes.
So it has this kind of inverted fairy tale feel to it. You know, it's about these two young kids who are being, you know, preyed upon for this hidden money that their late father has left for them that he stole. And in the process of them being kind of stalked by this predatory preacher, they travel through this quite, you know, pastoral environment, and you get all nature and the nature sounds around them and stuff. But there's just something there's like a lyrical kind of feel to it and a real kind of unworldly feel to it, I guess.
You mentioned the word fairy tale, and it's the one that often comes to mind when you look at stills of The Night of the Hunter, if you haven't seen it, or if you talk about it or think about it. And rewatching it, and I've seen it a number of times, both in the cinema and at home, the thing that always gets me into that fairy tale space with The Night of the Hunter is actually the soundscape. The soundscape, the music, the distortion of reality, depending, especially when it's from the point of view of the kids in the film. And I remember being so fascinated with it when I discovered it. And I think it was in Paris when I was studying film, and I saw it on some library DVD or something like that on a small computer screen back when you could see DVDs through your laptop. And I dove so deep into the history of the film and what it was, who Mitchum was, who Charles Laughton was. It was the first movie that I remember being completely obsessed with the making of from that era, and how odd it was considering the context in which it was made. Can you talk to me a little bit about the context in which The Night of the Hunter was created in and why it's such an oddball piece of cinema?
It really is an oddball film, because even if you were going to go out on a limb and say, okay, well, it's a Robert Mitchum film from 1955, so it would be, you know, you could place it handily in the genre of film noir. Mm-hmm. And because of its use, its very angular use of shadow and its dark subject matter, crime-oriented subject matter, you could try and make a case for that. But it really isn't like film noir in any traditional sense. It's too focused on the countryside. It's too focused on the... It's just too weird, frankly. Like, it's got too many other elements going yeah. on for it to just be a film noir. And it doesn't have the purely nocturnal or the purely urban that noir has either. It's just a different thing altogether. It's also Southern Gothic, you know? Mm-hmm. So it doesn't really feel like it's of a piece with that kind of film. Equally, in 1955, popular Hollywood fare was, you know, Technicolor musicals or big Westerns or, you know, things that were a little bit more easily categorized or fenced off into their particular type of genre. And Night of the Hunter doesn't really feel, it's not straight up horror in that supernatural. There's a real psychological element. There's a real twisted sexual element to it. There's just so many things going on in it, both visually and you know, kind of in terms of its tropes and its themes, that it just doesn't quite fit anywhere.
You're very right. And the inclusion and the way that the film also privileges the child's perspective makes it even weirder, considering how menacing and how sexually depraved the character of the preacher is. The fact that we can then switch from his perspective of the world to the children's perspective, which is a lot more innocent, and that you instinctively want to be protective of, feels like such a jarring experience even now. But can you tell me a little bit about who Charles Laughton was at the time of the making of this film? Because this is his only directorial effort.
Charles Laughton is a hugely respected actor mm-hmm. on the stage and screen. And yeah, this was, as you say, his only directorial effort, because he just took it very personally when the film did not meet the kind of success that he hoped for it. He read Davis Grubb's novel, which was the writer's first book, which was actually loosely based on a real serial killer in the Midwest in the late 1920s and early 1930s, which is not something I knew until fairly recently, which was a really interesting internet mm-hmm. rabbit hole to fall down. Mm-hmm. You know, a guy that was killing widows and their children for money, sort of thing. And so Charles Laughton was a nervous first-time director in spite of all of his experience. He, by all accounts on the set, often felt that, you know, he was maybe approaching, you know, everything wrong, and he would panic a little bit. Mm-hmm. But he, of course, had this incredible eye and this incredible talent for working with other actors. Mm-hmm. And he also had this incredible DP that he could lean on and learn from in terms of what he wanted to achieve visually. And that was Stanley Cortez, who shot The Magnificent Ambersons with Orson Welles, and also all the amazing Sam Fuller movies like Shock Corridor. So that was a guy who knew where to put the camera pretty instinctively.
And, you know, considering that he was so renowned as an actor, and I've spoken about some of his earlier films, particularly The Island of Dr. Moreau and The Show before, what do you think he brought? What do you think he brings out of his cast that maybe more experienced directors, but not performers, could have?
I think if you look at Shelley Winter's other performances, for instance, mm-hmm. Shelley Winter's plays Willa, the widow that becomes seduced and unfortunately eventually murdered by the Robert Mitchum character, by the preacher. By all accounts, they tried a few different actresses in that role, and many of them were much more of the glamorous kind, sort of the Grace Kelly types, that type sort of thing. And Laughton, I think, as an actor, instinctively saw that she was a more, you know, serious prospect. She's very serious about her study of acting technique. Mm-hmm. And he also got, you know, from her other performances to this one, I think there's something much more reserved and vulnerable and tender mm-hmm. about her here. So he knows how to calibrate each performance really well. And in addition, he's also working with children. Child mm-hmm. actors are not necessarily the easiest of territory, but he gets truly, you really feel for these kids. You really see the fear in their eyes. You get the sense that they're being coached quite well behind the scenes there.
There's a fascinating documentary, or really just an edited collection of rushes that's included on the UK Blu-ray release of it, which is just 2.5 hours of seeing Lawton direct, where you're not really seeing him, you're hearing him. And there's almost this like silent movie quality to it, because he keeps the camera rolling on the actors as he's making them go through the scenes over and over and over again. And sometimes you might get like 10, 15 minutes of the same, 20-second portion of the movie being done over and over and over again until he gets what he needs from them.
When you come down, say it like this. It's me, John and Pearl. You told me to come. Now try that. Move into that and say that.
You don't want me to say Harper?
It's me, John Harper and Pearl. You told me to come. Do it now.
It's me, John Harper and Pearl. You told me to come.
Now do that again. It's me, John Harper and Pearl. You told me to come.
It's me, John Harper and Pearl. You told me to come.
Really?
Uncle Bertie.
No, keep your head there now. Uncle Bertie, oh please.
Uncle Bertie, oh please.
No, wait a minute. Uncle Bertie, oh please.
Uncle Bertie, oh please. Please wake up!
Now then, Uncle Bertie, oh please. Please wake up! Uncle Bertie, oh please.
Uncle Bertie, oh please. Please wake up!
I've never done it, Johnny.
And I was reading, going down this rabbit hole again, that he really wanted and intended to bring the techniques of silent film, or the effect that silent film used to have on an audience, into a talking film. Like, how do you think he deploys that? Do you see those traces of silent movie filmmaking in The Night of the Hunter as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I think almost in its whole setup, its entire kind of the thrust of the film is very much a good versus evil, light versus dark thing. It mm-hmm. is about the corruptible, this is an authority figure, right? This is a man in the American South who's a preacher, or claiming to be a preacher in any case, who's preaching the word of God in his own twisted way,
mm-hmm.
Trying to prey upon the trust of these women and children. And so we very clearly delineate between the innocence of the pastoral maternal South and the maternal figure that's represented by the Lillian Gish character,
mm-hmm.
and this dark, corruptible, sexually depraved, violent male force. And I think that is something that in silent cinema, if you go back to films like the Murnau movies, for instance, their visual delineation between that good and evil, it's much more symbolic. It's much more kind of, I don't want to say simplistic, I think mm-hmm. that's the wrong word,
mm-hmm.
but there is a kind of very clear visual delineation. You get that in Night of the Hunter. You get that the blacks and the whites are very stark,
yeah.
and the shadow and light are very stark, and the good and evil is very stark. And I think there's a purity there. Of course, Lawton was also very influenced by D.W. Griffith. And Griffith was, he was actually the son of a Confederate soldier, famously, of course, made Birth of a Nation, and was, somewhat in love with this kind of Moonlight and Magnolia's image, this romantic image of the American South.
Mm-hmm.
And although we're not seeing that at all in Night of the Hunter, there is something in the visual vernacular which is quite similar.
Mm. And can you frame this a little bit more? You've mentioned Southern Gothic before, which it's just almost like a very area-specific subgenre of the Gothic. You mentioned this Moonlight and Magnolias thing. How does The Night of the Hunter fit and doesn't fit? How does it give us a sense of the South and attach itself to the Southern Gothic in that way?
It's a really interesting one, because it's, some people would argue that it's not exactly the South because it's near the Ohio River, but if it's West Virginia,
mm-hmm.
that's a former Confederate state. And yeah, so by definition, I guess you would say, and it's set during the Great Depression. It's set, mm-hmm. It's set. So, it's not contemporary to the time of the film's making. And it is about the rural Southern poor. Mm-hmm. So in and of itself, that kind of locates you in a particular milieu. But the Southern Gothic is often characterized by, and you know, it started out as a literary concept, as William Faulkner, Flannery O'Connor, those sorts of writers, but you know, by a darkness which is sort of the nightmares of the past, as often, you know, in reference to the ghosts of slavery. And if they're not directly about race, which The Night of the Hunter isn't, but they often dance around ideas to do with the hypocrisy of Southern authority figures like the law or religion in this case, the moral hypocrisy of religion, the sexual depravity around that stuff seems to come up a lot in both, say, Faulkner's novels and in films like this. And that it all could be related back to the sexual depravity and the moral hypocrisy of the slave owning South. So I think that would be a kind of a way to characterize the deeper roots of Southern Gothic. And in terms of Night of the Hunter, of course, we have the incredibly hypocritical white Southern male authority figure preacher. And we have, you know, it doesn't show the South as a completely rotten place either. It shows, you know, poor people that are struggling to get by. These children's father at the beginning is executed for stealing. I think it's just for stealing, right?
He doesn't. It is. No, he doesn't. Yeah. He doesn't murder anyone. He just steals.
Yeah. So, but you know, we see that as a sign of desperation in a time of, you know, during the Depression where he needed to feed his family. So we don't necessarily judge that kind of criminality the same way we judge the criminality of the preacher, which is a really, you know, even if it is just driven by money, there's a real sexual sadism and weirdness to it. There's more going on there than just, you know, money. So yeah, I think it's once again, it's a South of good and evil, but also of a great deal of kind of hypocrisy.
And there is the film really explores kind of the deceptions that authority figures can partake in and the disappointment that can exist in people when they realize that they cannot trust those authority figures. And it's interesting that Ben, the father character, who gets executed for stealing very early on, and the reason the preacher even targets his widow Willa and his children is because they share a cell for a short time. And Ben really sees through preacher's preacher deceit, kind of almost instinctively. He knows that he's preying on him to get some information out of him, even while he's sleeping, because he's sleep talking. And I wonder kind of how... I want to talk about Mitchum and his persona, what he brings to this role. He was a huge star at this point in his career, but what was his screen persona like, and how does this role use it or append it?
That's a great question. And I guess, like, in retrospect, people often associate Mitchum with this role, but it wasn't unusual role in a sense for Mitchum, who was no stranger to playing anti-heroes and no stranger to playing kind of guys who were on the wrong side of the tracks and guys who could be kind of quite rough and tough. He was a big man. He'd had an extremely rough and tumble upbringing. He'd ridden the rails during the Depression. He kind of was the real deal in that sense. He was sort of a hard drinker, had been in prison, you know, and had this tough guy persona. So that's one part of it. But he also could be very slick and very smooth and was, you know, quite a sexy figure. And he uses both the hardness and that kind of slickness in this part. He brings it together really wonderfully because he has the slyness to him. But you see that he knows exactly how to talk to women and that women are extremely charmed by him. He has this kind of blustery quality about him that seems to draw people in.
He's almost perverting his own status as a sex symbol. So, like, almost the fact that, you know, all the women in this movie are so deeply attracted to him, and even the older women in the community kind of talk about what a good match he would be and what a great shame it would be for him to go be without a wife, and are very quick to blame Willa for any kind of indiscretion instead of judging him or doubting his word at any point. And I think I texted even as I was rewatching this film. It's like he's incredibly alluring, even as you see the depth of his misogyny throughout the film. And you mentioned kind of the very dark, disturbed sexuality that exists underneath, that exists in The Night of the Hunter, kind of outside of all of his killing of women, ostensibly for their money. How does the film underscore his sort of quite violent hatred of women?
It's really quite shocking and pungent almost right from the start. He's talking to himself in the car. He's very, very blasé, counting off the widows that he's killed. But he also, you know, talks about his hatred for perfume smelling things, I think is what he says. Mm-hmm.
Lord, I am tired. Sometimes I wonder if you really understand. Not that you mind the killings. Your book is full of killings. But there are things you do hate, Lord. Perfume-smelling things, lacy things, things with curly hair.
Yeah, it's very clear that this man's repression has forced him to almost channel that into violence, and almost as though he can't really consummate his lust, or and certainly he never consummates his marriage to Willa for the same reasons, right? Because he's somewhat repressed and incapable, even though she's clearly has a lot of desire for him. Mm-hmm. This is this heartbreaking, awful moment where he sticks her in front of, like, shivering in mm-hmm. front of a mirror in their room, and says something like, your body's not made for the lust of men, or some moralistic kind of guilt inducing awful thing that he says to her. So mm-hmm. yeah, this guy is very clearly deeply fucked up.
Yeah, he really, like I mentioned before, really kind of perverts his appeal to women. He lures her in, he seduces her, he indulges her looking at him and wanting him, to then turn it around on her and humiliate her for that very same desire that he's welcomed and taken advantage of. And I think one of the most striking scenes even now for me is when he takes himself by himself, this before he's met Willa, to what is effectively a peep show. And he just stares at this woman dancing, and it's very on the nose phallic, but his little knife, pocket knife.
Yeah,
his switchblade pops through and kind of pierces the cloth of his jacket, as he's just staring so hatefully at this poor dancer. And it's almost like he wants to go and surround himself and find women to get him into that really violent, virulent space where he can almost justify his urges, his violence.
It's sort of, this might sound like a slightly, like, I don't know, tangential thing to say, but it's just made me think about, of all things, Mindhunter.
Okay.
And when they're talking about the motivations of sex-related serial killers,
mm-hmm.
and it's like, this is obviously years before that psychology was, people were talking about Freud and they were talking about psychiatry and stuff in the 50s, but I don't think they were profiling serial killers yet.
Not yet.
And this is, this idea that there's like a sexual drive behind, as if even when he does eventually kill Willa, he lays on top of her for a minute,
mm-hmm.
which almost implies some kind of necrophilic urge. Mm. But he can only be satisfied sexually by the act of homicide. There's something, I don't want to say ahead of its time, but it does seem to be quite psychologically, insightful in that way, I guess, about this kind of insane pathology.
Well, I think this is primarily one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about this film when thinking about serial killers than the movies, is because he is factually a serial killer. He finds his victims, he targets a specific kind of victim, he goes, he kills them, he moves on to kill again. But I think it's this pathology that we've become very used to. It's spawned its own cinematic, televisual genre, true crime as its own cottage industry that, you know, has a much longer tradition. But I think the film, you're right, kind of pays a lot of attention visually and in Mitchum's performance to the urges that he feels. Because it could have simply been about money. It could have just been greed. It could have just been need for money because of the setting during the Depression. But there is something more. I think the film really seems to imply that he derives some sort of gratification from it. That is kind of, because he can derive sexual gratification, he gets it from demeaning and killing these women.
Yeah, and I mean, that's, of course, steeply bleak, but it is also, it's, again, like, the visual side of it, as you say, is really underlines this in a way that makes it easy for the audience to infer, even if you aren't able to quite put words to it. And I'm sure a lot of audiences in 1955 probably wouldn't have been able, or even maybe not able, but willing to put words to it in that way. You know, it's a much more conservative society at that time. I always think, I know they had some trouble with the production code administration and with censorship, but they still managed to get it out there in spite of a lot of picketing and a lot of issues. It's still amazing to me that it managed to pass muster altogether.
Yeah. And, you know, on that note, how does the film portray violence, you know, particularly, how does it treat Willa's murder and its aftermath?
This is definitely not throwaway movie violence. Mm. This is, it's disturbing. It's genuinely very disturbing. And every act of violence has weight. I wouldn't say it's explicitly more graphic than another film from its time, but it is just executed and shot in a way. And also kind of the emotional buildup to that. Like, you really grow to care for the Shelley Winters character, and of course for these children who are completely innocent and helpless in this scenario. You can really feel the tragedy of the violence.
For me, it is really shocking and really kind of, for me at least, kind of makes me really stiffen up as I was watching it. And that's odd when you've seen a film several times over and over the years. But I think for me, it's the fact that she's almost near catatonic when he murders her. She's completely surrendered to him because he's almost taken the time to destroy her emotionally before he actually kills her fully, so that she doesn't fight. And she's shot kind of from above, and this almost all, she's already laying like a corpse in her bed, essentially waiting for him to kill her.
The children know where it's hid. John knows. Is that it, Harry? But it's still here amongst us, tainting us. You must have known about it all along, Harry. But that ain't the reason why you married me. I know that much. Because the largest one let it be. He made you marry me so you could show me the way in the life and the salvation of my soul. Ain't that so, Harry? So you might say that it was the money that brung us together. The rest of it don't matter.
And she's so small when, you know, this beautiful shadowy shot of her laying in their bed that he refuses to really share with her, and kind of waiting for him to kill her. Because she feels like there's something so deeply, because he's made her feel like there's something so deeply rotten about her that it must be destroyed.
Yeah, it's also, it's just thinking about the fact, the one thing that I always go back to when I think of Shelley Winters, which is perhaps unfair of me, though they are two of the best films of that decade, so maybe not. She obviously had a really long career, but only a few years before this, she was in A Place in the Sun. With Montgomery Clift, who also takes advantage of her vulnerability, her financial situation and her kind of good-natured puppy dog eyes for him, mm-hmm. and murders her and drops her in a lake, which is the same thing that happens to her in The Night of the Hunter. And it's like, man, people just kept doing this to Shelley Winters, this poor woman. What a way to get pigeonholed.
I mean, you bring up the shots under the lake, but there's several quite extended shots of Willa's body underwater, which mm-hmm. seems very out there for 1955. Not just the murder scene itself, but just the fact that we spend so much time seeing what's happened to her body. Do you feel like that was particularly daring for mid-50s Hollywood filmmaking?
Absolutely, because, I mean, that would have, I think, been perceived as extremely graphic. It's still disturbing now. Mm-hmm, it's not mm-hmm. because it's graphic in the way that we come to think of things as being graphic today, but to see what's happened to this woman that we've been, you know, watching and kind of hoping that she'd escape the situation, and mm-hmm. also knowing, of course, that her children are now, you know, completely defenseless. Mm-hmm. You know, she's not there to protect them. Seeing what's happening to her body and her body, the implication of her decomposing down there is so deeply morbid, mm-hmm. and I don't think audiences were prepared for that when most scenes of death or homicide were not interested in portraying the physical deterioration of a corpse. They were not mm-hmm. They were not showing the corpse. They were not showing dead bodies. They were not showing that kind of thing, and that's what we're seeing. And also just visually, mm-hmm. it has such a haunting look. You know, her hair is kind of like tendrils of her hair in the water, and it's just it's such a cinematic moment.
It's very beautiful, but also very, very distressing to look at, because you know she's just there, but not being able to be grieved properly. If anything, you know, after her disappearance, Harry once again puts on the sheep's clothing and cries very dramatically, saying that she's run away because she didn't love him enough, you know, that she was the one culprit to blame. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't know exactly how the idea for the shot or for incorporating that scene happened, but I do know that they shot it underwater in a tank at Republic Studios, I think, mm-hmm. and they used a mannequin that they affixed with Shelley Winters' likeness. But in terms of, you know, how they conceived of it, I'm not sure. It's incredible.
And, you know, you mentioned the children before, and we've discussed that it's hugely concerned with children, and kind of they are very much the anchors of the story. What role do Pearl and John Willis' children play in the film, kind of as we essentially transition from Harry's seduction and murder of Willa to him chasing the kids to find out where the money is hidden?
I mean, I think John particularly is very much the protagonist of the story. The children are the protagonists of the story. Mm. And it comes into its own with them and their journey towards the second half of the film, wherein what they know about the threats and the insidiousness of the preacher, you know, is mm-hmm. now completely, that mask has dropped in the second half of the film, and he has just become completely, you know, he's completely his full predatory monstrous self, mm-hmm. pursuing them down this river when they're on this boat. And that whole extended sequence is, you know, it's sort of combining this pure nightmarish terror of this kind of monstrous giant figure that they're helpless against. And also, sort of as I was saying, that this kind of odd, even though they're still these kind of innocent children, and they're looking around at the frogs and the wildlife and, you know, almost like on this little journey down this river, their own little adventure that they're going, this kind of nightmarish adventure that they're on. Mm-hmm. It's just such an interesting POV.
It is, and I think it also adds to this fairy tale-esque aspect to the film, because it sort of distorts their reality, because it is seen through the eyes of scared children. So, you know, one of my favorite shots is when they see him singing in the night and kind of looking for them atop his horse. And it's an unbelievable shot, but also they hear him as though he were singing in their ears very close to them, even though he's very far away and he couldn't possibly see them. It all seems to be kind of compacted through the children's emotional point of view more than reality.
Exactly. And so then instead of having, even if you say like the heightened artificiality of noir, which is also the kind of exists in the visual, like the psychological visual, like matrix of the subconscious, mm-hmm. or, you know, the kind of emotion making things feel heightened in that way. It has a bit of that. But also something a little bit older, like we keep saying, fairy tale, or mm-hmm. going back to this kind of classic literary gothic tradition, which is about entrapment and being preyed upon by hypocritical, powerful male figures, violent male figures. And so it becomes a story of innocence versus experience and good versus evil, and eventually of Lillian Gish as this kind of very warm maternal presence who can, by her Christian righteousness as well as her femininity, protect these children.
Yeah, so tell me what do you make of the role of Rachel, who's Lillian Gish's kind of Mother Goose character? What does she add to the story?
She's such a strong presence. And of course, Gish was the one of the great stars of a silent era with D.W. Griffith's direction. So it makes sense that Charles Laughton, being inspired by those films, would have reached out to her to be in the film. I think he said something to her along the lines of, you know, people used to sit up straight back when you were in pictures. And yeah, it was really good. Mm. And now people slump over, eat their popcorn. I want people to sit up straight again.
Such a great line.
So he obviously had a lot of respect for her. And so she took the role on, obviously, you know, fairly advanced age. And she presents this is the incredible moment where she's, you know, framed in shadow on the porch with a shotgun. And there's a back and forth in dialogue between her and the preacher outside of her home. She's protecting the children within. And he's bearing down on the home, and he's threatening, and he's singing that absolutely haunting sort of, I don't know, it's like a hymn or some kind of religious song that he sings that I can hear in my head whenever I think about this film. That kind of, she's the only one who in the entire film that you really feel can immediately has the clarity, aside from, I guess, Ben, who is not very long in the film at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Has a clarity and the kind of moral righteousness to see through him. So there is an element of you know, and I don't know how much this is Charles Laughton, how much this is David Scrubb, how much this is the PCA's influence about Christianity, the idea that you would show a preacher, an actual preacher, a man of God, to be, you know, this depraved and this, and that he could then twist the words of God into something that would give him justification for this kind of behavior. Was obviously very upsetting to the censor, would have been upsetting to a lot of the religious public at that time. Mm. So in a way, it sort of softens his hypocrisy with her, the strength of her being a good Christian woman, and it gives a little bit more to the faith-based aspect of it, you know. So I wouldn't say it's conservative, but it does, there's an element of that there.
There is, and it's also an interesting kind of change up to the formula that would emerge even a few years later with films like Psycho and Peeping Tom, because usually there is an element of a detective, of someone, another figure of authority trying to find and solve the murders, trying to find the culprit. And there is police involved in this story, but they're so tangential and so, you know, much more concerned with just almost like not willing to see through Harry Powell's stratagems or through his sheep's clothing, and much more concerned with kind of taking people to prison and kind of, you know, executing them. And closing that case rather than even allowing the possibility of someone like that to be getting away with his actions for so long, making it even, which has always made it even more of a curiosity for me alongside all these other kind of killer films that have come out around roughly the same time. But what was the contemporary reaction to the film? You know, you mentioned at the start that the critics not really getting it was so upsetting to Lawton that he, partly because of this, never made another film as a director. How did people react at the time, and how did it become reassessed?
I think people, you know, at the time found it wrong-footing, surprising, disturbing. You know, there were a few critics who had some praise for it, but often the praise was tempered by, you know, it's his first film as a director, it's a bit amateurish, it's a bit choppy, it's a bit strange, it's lit weirdly, it's, you know, a lot of the things that we've now come to see are incredibly exacting and intentional. And, you know, to me, it has a completely consistent tone and a completely, like, it, you know, it's one of the great films that brings you into a particular world and a particular perspective and a particular, I guess, for lack of a better way of putting it, vibe. And yeah, it seems odd to me that at the time people didn't seem to see that as a positive. They just were like, what a weird little movie. So yeah, I mean, the 50s were, as I said, sort of quite a socially conservative time in America. Mm-hmm. And I just think it was an odd one. And going back to what you were talking about previously about authority and the cops, mm-hmm. it is really interesting because it's almost like, you know, the cops are not maybe willfully siding with the other image of male authority, but they're not effective in the way that the very patrician 1950s probably would have preferred for their storytelling in many ways.
And where do you see the film's influence, be that visually or otherwise?
I mean, I think it's everywhere in terms of, I mean, like the Coen brothers, Tarantino, and all of the oddballs and sickos that you kind of find in their kind of picaresque images of American life.
Mm-hmm.
There's like a ground zero in Harry Powell. And of course the con man preacher was a figure that show up in so many films throughout the 50s and 60s. So I think, it's not just visual really with Night of the Hunter, because there are a lot of things that try to kind of look like it, but not really. I think mostly it's in, like, in its spirit, in its psychology, in its depiction of these characters. And I think, yeah, like Mitchum being this kind of all-time great, meeting of role and performer and writing, where he personifies the, you know, the whole beware of false prophets thing. He personifies that if it seems too good to be true, it probably is kind of vibe. The all-American religious, conservative, whatever, con man. That's somebody that we just is kind of a mainstay, certainly in like 90s American indie film and stuff like that.
It's interesting you mentioned the word con man several times, because there's been, you know, this is not particularly new, but there's been so much interest and fascination with the con man as a heroic figure, as a very slick anti-authoritarian figure that's, you know, using the system and breaking apart for their own purposes, and kind of an outlaw, a roguish outlaw. But Preacher is a really dark version of that. He is using the system to his advantage, but that's guided as much by greed as it is by a very perverse, very angry sexuality. And Mitchum, between this and Max Cady, his character in Cape Fear. That name escaped me for a minute. And Cape Fear, which came out a few years after this in 62, really kind of has this handle on very sexually violent characters who use his movie star allure to complicate our relationship with them, and because of that make them more enduring.
And it's such a prototype for, you know, even like the way people talk about Ted Bundy as like, oh, you know, he was so charming, and that kind of, you know, I think that's, yeah, it's really interesting how that's kind of trickled into contemporary discourse or contemporary depictions of serial killers. so forth.
And obviously the love-hate tattoos have just become a very, very quick and easy visual emblem of this movie, even though people might not recognize where it's from.
Yeah. I mean, the more I think about it, just through having this conversation, really, you know, you were saying about his much darker version of, you know, this is a child killer. This is a, you know, amongst everything else. And it really is such a, in an era that I think was a great era for American film anyway, but it really is like a very anti everything about mainstream America of this time, which was a very like domestic, antiseptic, family oriented, clean cut kind of Eisenhower America. This film is just like, what kind of rock did they pull this grimy, weird, beautiful film from under, you know? And it's, yeah, so great.
It is much like Harry Powell. It is a deeply confusing watch because it is so beautiful and so ingeniously made. And the soundscape and the music of it is so enchanting. But what you're seeing depicted on screen is so violent that it's confusing because you're both charmed and appalled by it.
And in that way, it matches its villain perfectly.
Exactly. Christina, thank you so much. Is there anything else you wanted to add about The Night of the Hunter or Harry Powell as a character that we haven't covered?
Not that I can think of.
Thank you so much for your time and for your insight on this mutual fave of ours.
No worries. It was a pleasure.